Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Before we get to it, a word about our sponsor. The University of Dallas is a premier Catholic liberal arts institution, renowned for its rigorous core curriculum and thriving graduate programs. Careers in ministry, teaching, business, humanities, and science are formed here. With campuses in Texas and Rome, Italy, students begin their pursuit of a life well lived. We have two alums of Dallas here at First Things on staff, and they are both superb. For more information on the University of Dallas, visit udallas.edu. That's udallas.edu. Hans Zeiger is president of the Jack Miller Center, an organization founded to support civics and history education. He wrote an essay in Law and Liberty on a timely topic, donations to elite universities that actually some which have gone pretty darn woke these days and shown an alarming tolerance in the last few months, as we all know, for identity politics and especially anti-Semitism after the October 7th episode. The piece is called The Next Step for Disaffected Donors. That's our topic today. Welcome, President Zeiger.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's great to be with you.
First, just quick update. The Miller Center started, what, about 12, 15 years ago? Just tell us what you do.
Yeah, the Jack Miller Center was started actually 2 decades ago. And it was a quiet, but very serious, very energetic venture to grow the bench of scholars of the American political tradition. And that effort has, I would say, taken off in some new ways in more recent years as we've gotten into K-12 lines of effort, getting scholars connected with K-12 social studies teachers to get them up to speed on how to present primary source texts in their classrooms. But I would describe us as an educational venture to build a talent pipeline for the emerging generation of America's civic educators. And one of the key activities we do is getting junior scholars into an elite fellowship program every summer. And so we build cohorts of scholars year after year. We've been doing this for 20 years. And then as fellows take their part in our community of scholars, now over 1,100 strong on more than 330 campuses, the center really operates as a clearinghouse to drive strategic investments in scholars' career advancements. So aiding them to secure tenure, to take on and succeed in leadership roles, and to implement innovations and best practices for education in the liberal tradition. So very, very pleased to be doing this. I come out of the political arena. I was 10 years in the Washington State Legislature, short time in local government, but came to realize that really the major challenge of our generation is to recover civic education in our country, that is fundamental to the future of our country and to responsible citizenship.
I think more and more people on the left and the right are coming around to that as well. You're in a timely position here. My goodness, civics education, bringing up young Americans to be good citizens.
And by the way, thank you for the attention that you've been paying to civics on this podcast. I know you've had Chris Senecola and Jonathan Barth, Josiah Ober as some recent guests talking about this topic.
Great. Well, it is pressing. And your background there in state government probably better than having an all academic background, I think. Having someone like you in the room with academics is crucial, I would say.
I started out on an academic pathway after doing a master's in public policy at Pepperdine University. I went over to the other side of Los Angeles and started a PhD in political science. But I dropped out of that when I was running for the state legislature, ended up winning my first election by 29 votes out of 52,000 cast in 2010.
And what district were you in then? Los Angeles?
I was in the state of Washington. So okay, too far from Tacoma.
Okay.
Puyallup is my hometown. And, probably certainly learned more about practical politics by taking that course of action than had I stayed in the PhD program. But I've always appreciated those who commit their careers to the life of the mind, and particularly to the civic purpose of the intellectual foundations of our country, which are absolutely serious and absolutely real. I mean, when we think about civics, we often think, you know, middle school, memorizing a certain list of facts, you know, how many members are on the Supreme Court, what are the branches of government, those kinds of things. And we know that the civic knowledge of Americans is rather dismal when it comes to just knowing those facts.
Yep.
But the kind of civic knowledge that we ought to have in this country is far more advanced than that. It is a deep reflective thinking about the themes of freedom and why we should avoid tyranny and what does it take to be responsible as a self-governing citizen in a free society. What is a free society? You know, what are human rights? I mean, these are the kinds of questions George Washington talked about in his first message to Congress. And he said, you know, it's important for the leaders in a republic to know about that stuff, but it's important for the population as a whole to know about that stuff.
Yeah,
and yeah. We have neglected that badly at every level of education.
For a few years there at Emory, when I would teach freshman comp, I might orient it around some civic theme. And one paper assignment I had them do was, when you go downtown, this is at Emory University, go downtown to Atlanta City Hall. And I'm gonna get you the schedule of city council meetings. And I want you to sit in the back for 2 hours and just watch the city council meetings and report what you see. That's where a lot of the civics takes place. And it was, yes. It was great. They all loved it. They really opened their eyes to a lot of things. So but let's get we'll get Hans to the topic of your essay. The donor situation and higher education. How would you characterize the state of mind of the wealthy donor to a college, say in 2010? Someone wants to give money, someone done well, business world. In 2010, what is that donor thinking about the colleges and that world?
Well, the typical profile of a donor is somebody who's an alumnus of, you know, they're giving to their alma mater. And there's a deep loyalty there. Right. There's an emotional and relational tie that goes back to their formative experiences. And, you know, higher education, for all of its flaws, remains to this day a great engine for dynamism, a great engine for economic growth and development in our country. It remains the premier destination for people from all around the world to come and get a higher education. People come from all over.
Yeah.
And there is much to admire about higher education. There's much to admire about the breakthroughs in scientific discovery and in curing diseases. All of those things are so critical. But at the same time, there are ideological activities that have been happening on college campuses, very much bent in a particular direction. For a very long time. And I would say that a larger problem even than that is an ethic of relativism that has predominated, where there is a refusal to take any kind of stand or to acknowledge that the purpose of a university is the pursuit of truth. And so the reason why ideology has been able to find a home on college campuses is because there's a void of any sense that the purpose of this enterprise is to pursue truth. And so ideology comes into that void. It's accepted because universities have taken this attitude of being all things to all people and the kind of moral disposition that goes with that when it comes to moral questions is one of relativism. I mean, Alan Bloom talked about this kind of development on college campuses a long time ago. And a lot of people paid attention to that. A lot of people were aware of that critique and continued to support their alma mater. So, but I think what's happened in the last, 3-4 months is a real sea change. I think you have major donors and some, you know, who are all across the spectrum of alumni and donors to higher education saying, we see what's going on now and we don't like what we see. It is disturbing to see the rise of anti-Semitism following October the 7th, to see the way that administrations have handled that and the display of relativism that they have shown.
The testimony of those college presidents, you're right. that underlying that was the display of relativism. Well, it's a better context. It's a, and so, you know, I didn't think of that as relativism, but you're right. You're right. That's sort of the fundamental premise.
Right. Yeah. And they can say, you know, they said many times in the congressional hearing, you know, they're against anti-Semitism. Okay. So we know what they're against, but there's never any acknowledgement of what we're for. And so then you start to chip away at being able to make any kind of firm commitment. And so then they're starting to make all these, you know, exceptions or, you know, well, we're going to defend free speech on campus which means we're going to be all things to all people in their definition of that.
Right. Right. Well, you say people attitudes have changed. Were the donors, were a lot of donors a little naive? Was their conception of the campus really 1971 when they graduated rather than, you know, 2018 when the woke stuff was really hitting?
Well, I you know, there's certainly a continuity between things happening 50 plus years ago to what has been happening more recently, but certainly there's an in-your-face quality of what has been happening recently that has caused some people to wake up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think probably people who may have not paid attention to certain developments on campus in their own time on campus, who've had certain life experiences that have made them realize that have honed their values and made them appreciate what really, you know, the purpose of higher learning ought to be, that they bring a little different lens to that once they're exposed to what's happening on campus.
Well, and one thing you note in the essay, it's not just the donors, it's the public in general. You note that the Correct. Public confidence in higher education is now 36%. That's a big drop. Have you seen colleges, administrators taking a good hard look in the mirror and saying, whoa, we're doing something wrong here? I mean, the public, we can't have a public be damned attitude about this. I mean, how would you say administrators look at that number? What do they think?
Well, there's a lot of things going on, and it's not just kind of the moral and ideological things we're talking about here in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months. There, a lot of parents, students, other Americans were beginning to question the value proposition of a higher education, certainly a 4-year degree. I mean, as far back as the recession of 2008, 2009, when, you know, the price of a higher education had ballooned. It was one of the most expensive things that any American was ever going to pay for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what kind of a job was somebody going to get with a 4-year degree?
So you know, Hans, I'm older than you are, and I'm going to say something a little shocking to you. When I started at UCLA, you know, UCLA in 1980, the tuition was about maybe $600 a year. Hmm. A year. That was it. Anyway, that's not what it is now. But please, go ahead.
No, and I started to pay attention to this when I was a member of the state legislature in the state of Washington. And I sat on the higher education committee and I started paying attention to cost drivers. You know, what are the things that are really causing the price to go up for tuition payers, for taxpayers, for others who are involved in higher ed? And, you know, a few things really come to mind. One is administrative bloat. I mean, you name a problem, there's a dean or an assistant dean or a vice president or whatever to deal with that problem. Yeah, so administrative bloat is a real challenge. And a lot of faculty would point to that as a challenge that they see as well.
Yeah.
A second thing is research bloat. And, you know, I pointed to the dynamism that higher education drives in our country. And so there is a very important role for research. I would absolutely acknowledge that. But we have elevated research as the primary value for every discipline across the academy. And I don't know that that's appropriate. There are disciplines where teaching has relatively higher value than research. And we have not accorded that value in higher education. And so we're paying for research, and that is a cost driver.
It is. I'll tell you, about 10 years ago, I did a study of research productivity in English, fields of English, and I profiled four different campuses about how much money is paid to English professors to do research. And then that's the cost. What is the benefit here? And Hans, the vast, vast majority of articles and books hardly ever get read. Hmm. Tons of labor hours have gone into, and remember, the state is paying people to do this research. This is government-funded research to produce these books and articles. No one ever looks at them. No one ever, they go into the library and they sink into darkness. Why in the world are we spending all this money on research that no one cares about? I mean, in the humanities. I can't talk for the sciences, but what a waste. What a waste of money, and what a waste of human capital, human labor.
Well, in many ways, it is the problem that my organization, the Jack Miller Center, was created to address, because you have this narrow research agenda that is rewarded in history and in political science and in related fields that ought to be concerned about the civic purpose of our country, about the civic purpose of an education. And instead of valuing teaching in those subjects, teaching our civic traditions, we value ever more narrow research agendas. And that creates a problem, also creates a cost problem that is causing more and more people to question the value proposition of a higher education. The third thing that I would point to that is a cost driver is this notion that a university should be all things to all people. And I mean, this is a mindset that has been predominant for at least a century. I mean,
university should cover the universe.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you want to come and major, and what you want to come and major, we'll make that available. You know, we should have every kind of sport. We should have every kind of, club available, every kind of. And so there's this failure to specialize across universities, failure to kind of stand for anything in particular or to be known for anything in particular, one thing over another. And so that's becoming a problem for universities, and there's oversaturation in the market. Last year, there were 15 colleges, mostly small colleges, that shut down because the market can't bear the number of institutions that are out there anymore. There's a lot of change that has to happen in higher education. And by the way, the pandemic caused a lot of people to question the value proposition of a four-year degree, because here people were paying all this money, and then they're sitting in Zoom meetings, and there's a lot more cost-effective ways to sit in Zoom meetings and get quality content than a lot of people are experiencing at that point.
What you refer to disaffected donors. Have those donors done anything more, with a couple of cases like Ackman? Have they done more than close their checkbooks? Have they actually contacted? Well, maybe I should ask you. How has the relationship between colleges and big donors changed?
Well, I would say that there was a factor in donor pressure that resulted in the resignations of the presidents of Harvard and Penn. Obviously, there was a major public backlash following their testimonies at the congressional hearing, but that is worth noting. You also have donors who are organizing. They're not just saying we're going to individually withdraw money, but they're talking to people in the administration and as well as fellow alumni.
Yeah.
And I think that, this goes hand in hand with what you mentioned about the dropping public approval for higher education. And so administrators have to be paying attention to this. Trustees have to be paying attention to this.
Do you see them as allowing donors to have a little more of an informal advisory role in the direction of the college?
Well, I think there's certainly some reluctance to do that. There's a lot of faculty who would be reluctant to see donors in that role. But, and you certainly don't want to just hand over the keys to somebody just because they have money. But they're important stakeholders in the discussion. Alumni are important stakeholders. And, you know, there's a kind of conscience that they're bringing to bear on these institutions at this point, which is a valuable role to play. Here are people with life experience who have some affection for their alma mater, yeah, who are saying, you have failed in a moral sense, and we are calling you to account, and institutional stakeholders should pay attention to that.
You, as you said, you tie the current decay of academics to this really a longstanding deterioration of academic values. And you cite Alan Bloom and Bloom's regret at what he was seeing. You know, the book was a huge bestseller, right, at the time. But I don't think of any cases where it really, you know, donors, would donors have the attitude that a lot of American parents have towards schools? They might have a low opinion of the public school system in general, but they always think their own school is okay. Did you see that in the donors? They don't want to believe that, you know, the place where they spent very formative years, right? Those years, 18 to 22 or 24, master's degree, whatever, were very important to a lot of these people. And they do have that loyalty going on.
Yeah.
And is now, how much is that broken? Can it be repaired?
I do think it can. And there is going to be an abiding loyalty there for most alumni. And so I think we have to acknowledge that as well. So my plea is not, you know, all alumni, all donors should just abandon higher education. I know there's a mindset out there of some who would say, you know, higher education is totally broken. We should focus on other things, or we should focus on other kinds of advanced education beyond K-12, like trade schools and community colleges, which I do think are great places for people to invest and places that deserve more attention. At the Jack Miller Center, we're just in the beginning stages of a program for community college professors, who are a group that few have paid any attention to at the national level. Yeah. But let me just, so the plea that I would make to donors and alumni out there is to say, if you care about the future of higher education, you should also invest in talent pipelines for leaders and scholars in the institutions that you care about. You know, that we need good professors who are going into all of the fields and are going to commit their lives to the teaching of the liberal tradition, to teaching of values that affirm the importance of truth, who see, you know, the civic purpose of an education. Certainly, you know, in the organization I serve, you know, that civic purpose is front and center for everything that we think about, and higher education has neglected that for a long time, by and large.
Yeah. Now, the fact that, you know, Harvard has, I think its endowment crossed $50 billion recently. Emory, where I was, I think they're 10 or 11 billion. The massive wealth of these really super elite campuses, they are still highly sensitive to donors, aren't they?
I mean, I think that recent events have shown that they are, even including at the Ivy Leagues. Now, what does that mean long term for the elite institutions in our country? I think it may mean something a little bit different than it means for the vast majority of institutions that are, you know, state universities, small private colleges that maybe don't have that size of endowment, and where I think the pressure to adapt is maybe even stronger than it would be at some of these elite institutions with the big endowments. And, you know, so if you're a state university, you darn better be paying attention to public pressures, donor pressures, and a number of state legislators are really paying attention to this now. I mean, when I was in the state legislature, higher education policy was often not the foremost kind of politically interesting topic for legislators to go work on. But
yeah,
I think it is becoming a much more visible subject for public policymakers to work on. And we're seeing, you know, I think one of the most positive things happening right now on the public higher ed landscape is the development of schools of civic thought at several public universities throughout in several states, but in some states, multiple universities.
Yeah.
And these are standalone academic units that can control their own hiring and tenure decisions and are funded, enacted by state legislatures, and are off to a good start. I mean, the first one of these was Arizona State University's School for Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership. But now we're seeing new innovative models at University of Texas, Austin, University of Florida, and a number of others. So I am very optimistic about what these innovative programs can do to recover the civic purpose of higher education, to recover a liberal arts kind of a focus in public higher education, to encourage the work of good scholars and good college level teachers. So there's some good things happening out there that people ought to be aware of.
And this would be one of the steps for disaffected donors, to come to your title. Donors, look for these little units. Can donors tailor or earmark their donations towards specific projects and programs with universities? Do they let donors do that?
Absolutely, and they should. They should keep an eye on how that money is spent. I mean, I hear from donors from time to time, I feel like I was misled because I gave to one thing, but the university went around, you know, spent it for another purpose. And so donor intent is absolutely critical. And there are some ways that you can, you know, make sure that your donor intent is respected by giving to specific programs and keeping in touch with people who you trust who are administering those programs.
What was your point about trade schools and technical colleges?
Well, these, you know, for one thing, they're supplying a real economic need that we have in our society, and they're non-ideological by and large. I mean, they are just focused on training people for careers that we need in our society. And they, you know, in the case of community colleges, very well attuned to the needs of their specific local economy. And they're open to all. And I suspect that, you know, if people want to invest their dollars there in their own local community, that they're going to see a great return.
How public should donors be in their actions on this score? I mean, you mentioned a lot of donors are sort of getting together, forming networks. Should they do that openly? Any problem with publicity or any help publicity could give to put pressure, maybe the right kind of pressure on schools? What do you think?
No, I think there is something to be said for donors getting together. I mean, I think of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni as a great organization for donors, trustees, alumni to rally to, and they've been doing good work for a long time, doing good research, doing good network building. So that's just one example of an organization that I would point to.
There's much more in the essay about supporting the centers. One can go to the Jack Miller Center website and find out about a lot of these centers in places around the country and the scholars program for people who are interested. But for now, the article in Law and Liberty was the next step for disaffected donors. Hans Iger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks for all you do.